Sometimes we simply must break the pattern and escape the rat race. We must go to someplace different, like the Tuscany. And we must do something different, like start a vineyard. And so today we are going to the Tuscany to start a vineyard.
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 568th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or, hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in St. Peterport who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Dave Michaels on the boards. Hello, Dave.
Glad to be here.
Producer Carol Stafford on the phones.
Hello there.
And holy smokes, it's wife Marlene going to sit in and co-host the show. Say hello.
How do you do?
Okay, folks, sometimes it is essential to break out of the day-to-day, to go to someplace new, to see things in a new light. And so today we are going to the Tuscany to see what it is like to start a new vineyard. And here to lead the way, we have Ferenc Mattei, author of A Vineyard in Tuscany. Ferenc, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael. And I love the introductory music. It was the perfect, the vineyard blues.
Dave, engineer Dave Michaels, way to go there on that one. So, a vineyard in Tuscany, but where was your rat race?
Well, mostly New York.
New York?
Candace, my wife was going, finishing her master's degree in arts. And
so a painter and a writer, huh?
Yes, two absolutely outcasts. And this is before Soho and New York got picked up as the sort of commercial center of New York. It was abandoned warehouses and stuff. And we lived down there and doing art school in the day and writing in the day and bars at night. And at one point, we were traveling through Europe. And we were in Italy, in Tuscany, and researching for a book on sailboats. And Candace had reached an age, I think she was in her mid-30s. She said, look, I'm tired of bars. I'm tired of New York. I'm tired. I just want to settle down and have a family and a house and a garden. And I said, how about here? What's wrong? She said, well, this is Italy. You know, you don't speak the language. She said, I can learn. I said, I'm going to have a little farm and plant some grapes and some olives. And she said, you don't know anything about farming. And I said, I'll go to school. And then she looks at me and says, you don't even know where you are. And I said, I'll ask somebody. So that was it. We rented a house for a month and actually went about buying a house there and selling it down.
And boom, just like that. Let me ask you this.
Nothing is boom just like that in Italy. Everything is slow and steady.
Which is another question we want to get to. But you, why the Tuscany and why not like Winnemucca, Nevada?
Isn't it bizarre? You know, strangely enough, I just did La Jolla and Laguna Beach and mm-hmm. Southern San Francisco or Southern California for a book tour for a vineyard in Tuscany. And being Italian, Hungarian, I love to drive, so I found this amazing road that connects 5 to Highway 101, sort of. And it goes from nowhere to nowhere. It's 198. Have you ever driven it?
Probably. I think that I have driven every road in California.
Well, that was perfectly after a roller coaster. Not only does it curve, but it humps, you know, so you're mm-hmm. airborne about 3 or 4 times.
Have you ever driven around southern New Zealand, the South
no.
Island? Well, that's
or,
it's like
or,
that, yeah.
We're going to do one up my ship here on roads, right? No, but I was going to say that the country's beautiful there, you know, rolling hills. Mm-hmm. So now you have to add some medieval towns and some vineyards and some olive groves and Florence and Venice and Pisa, you get in Tuscany. I'm from Europe. I was born in Transylvania and brought up in Hungary. I was 11 when I left. And I think that the sizes of measures of things in Europe, especially in Tuscany, really appeals to humanity. I think everything is such a human scale. You know, there are small
Ooh.
Vineyards, small towns, small farms. The fields are very shaped into the land.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing is bulldozed or very little is leveled or squared. It's, you know, ancient borders and stuff. It's very easy to feel at home there. I think, you know, genetically, we're small town people, have been for a few million years, you know, so or hamlet or village people. And I think that's with us. I mean, I think we all feel, why do we seek out places, you know, in the summers like Mendocino or or small American towns where, you know, people recognize us, and you go to, when you go and buy a loaf of bread or go to the butcher's, it's a social event, okay? You chiacchierare is what's called in Italian. You gossip about anything and everything, and you lament about your life, he laments about his life, you know. It's part of the social structure, and you feel very much like you belong somewhere, even if you're
human
language.
That's the human scale.
It really is, and you know.
What about a little bit about the history of Tuscany as opposed to Italy? I mean,
well,
when people rave about Italy, it always seems like they're raving about Tuscany.
Well, you know, it has remained very, it was very mountainous and hilly, and so it has remained much poorer than the industrial north or the sort of broad plains of the middle around Bologna. So even after the war, there was nothing to develop. You know, there's nothing really grew there.
You talk about one valley where they tried to import the tomato industry.
Yes, there is that one flaw, I must say, near Siena. These guys actually built this 20-story silo and a tomato factory. This was one of those, you know, brilliant government projects. They planted about 100 acres of tomatoes, and there was huge fanfare about this, how you know, Tuscany will reach into the new industrial age. And the tomatoes were planted 1 week, and next week they were all dead. They dried in the heat. People forgot that there's no water in Tuscany. But the silo is still there as a monument to stupidity.
So there really wasn't any easy way for them to industrialize the area. And with respect to that, I think it was Thomas Jefferson said that you have to plant wine grapes where nothing else grows.
That too, but in olives as well, you know, in the rocky hillsides.
All the same thing,
But don't forget, the big thing is transportation. You know, I used to drive. We bought the first house, that was the finished house. It was restored, very small, with no land around it. So I ended up spending 4 or 5 years looking for a ruin to restore. In other parts, I had a sort of Pygmalion complex that I would take something old and broken down and turn into some kind of magical castle. You know? But in all my travels, I swear, in our area, there isn't a stretch of road that's more than a couple hundred yards long that's straight. It's all curves and hills and bumps and that's slow, right?
It's just slower.
Very slow. It's wonderful. You know, if you like to drive or bicycle, it's just fabulous for your soul, you know. I think all those things held it back, you know, and plus the population was encouraged to abandon farms and abandon villages after the war and go into areas that are already industrial. So the land around Tuscany remained really virgin, and a lot of small towns are very, very undeveloped. You know, some new housing around it, but very minor. And the laws are very strict. You can't do anything.
Yeah, that's one of the things I want to talk about, the laws later. But let me get to the two other elements of the Tuscany that we all find very fascinating. One is the food.
Oh, yes. Well, we have a few days to talk about this. The quick and sort of used up answer to this is that Tuscans really don't actually. Oh, just lost a picture on the table.
Got a little excited when it comes to food. The pictures start flying around.
Something got me jittery, didn't you? It was 3 hours to lunch here. We don't really eat to live. We live to eat, you know. And seriously, we still have two large sit-down meals a day that could possibly in America easily pass for a Thanksgiving dinner. And even the stonemasons that I worked with, I was the sole carpenter in the house that we actually ended up restoring for a year and a half. Even they would sit down and start a fire in a little barbecue and roast their steak, and they've had this little five-tier stainless steel portable lunch, you know, and they had five-course meals and had their wine with it and their grappa, and they'd be totally kind of staggering around. They have two shots of espresso in a little espresso maker in the fireplace, and then we have all afternoon human missiles charging around, throwing stones like you wouldn't believe it. And the mason, the head mason, he would stop at a few minutes before lunch and wash up and change his shirt and go off to a little restaurant, a little white tablecloth, silverware restaurant, and have a little five-course meal there, you know. And, sacred. Food is really sacred. And it's not just the meal itself. It's the preparation of the meal that's a huge thing. You know, I mean, women do spend hours cooking Tuscan males are terribly macho. They don't go in the kitchen except for eating. But they do grow the food. You know, most houses in the country still have a pig or a few chickens, and they have their little vineyards, and they have their own olives or olive oil, and enormous vegetable gardens. I mean, you would not believe the patches.
Well, let me ask you, there's one final element about the Tuscany that captured my soul, and I think it's the light.
Oh, that's true. Isn't that... Well, you have two different lights. You have the when the wind blows from the north, the tramontana, the air becomes very clear and brilliantly blue. The skies are brilliantly blue, and you can see forever. You know, so you have this wonderful sharpness, fresh air feeling. And then when the wind turns and blows from the south, the mist comes in, and it's not a thick mist, but it's just enough to make the light sort of soft and kind of languid.
Okay, folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're with Ferenc Mate, and we're talking about a vineyard in Tuscany. Join us. Pull up your chair, fasten your seatbelt. We're going to Tuscany to start a vineyard. Right back. Do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson. Today we're breaking out of our mold and doing something different. We're on our way to the Tuscany in Italy to start a vineyard, and we're doing it with... Marlene's won't let go of the book. Ferenc Mate, author of A Vineyard in Tuscany. And Marlene and I have had some Tuscany experiences, and we both enjoy great wine. We both enjoy great food, and we both fell in love with the Tuscany. So today we're going to journey back with the help of Ferenc to that wonderful place. Ferenc, Marlene, and I helped pioneer a vineyard of Bordeaux-style grapes up in southern Oregon. And it was really a simple process. We went up there with some axes and chopped down trees, and we laid out the lines, and we drilled holes in the ground, and we put the vines in. And 20 years later, we were just up there, and we sampled some of the 2004. We opened our first bottle, and it was just superb. And the wine critics were giggling and happy and smiling. And you did the same thing in Tuscany, but I think the experiences might have been a little bit different.
Well, first of all, you can't cut down trees because everything's protected. You know, your little field that is designated as a field remains a field, and a forest remains forest.
So you just can't go into...
Which is why Tuscany is so beautiful, because it has remained intact, you know, for the last few hundred years, even though it was deforested many, many areas. It was deforested before.
You can't just ride into Tuscany and and start a farm and live happily
well,
ever
can.
After?
No, you can. When we bought finally found this 13th century ruin. It was a friary, which was where friars lived and worked. We had 70 acres, but it's not like half of it was woods and half was fields, but it wasn't, you know, one half, that half is fields, that half is woods. It was the woods with a few acres of field in it. Then you will go across another 10 minutes in the woods, another field, you know, so it's these wonderful shaped little fields that are designated now as fields or pastures or vineyards, and you can plant whatever you want in there. You have to get permits to plant vineyards, of course, because our zone is protected. It's an appellation, so you can only plant vineyards if you have a license to plant a vineyard. We're in Montalcino, where we make the Brunello, which most of your wine fans probably know of, and it's very highly protected. You can only plant so many, or you can only have so many pounds of grapes per acre. You can only produce so many liters of wine per acre, so it's very, it's kind of controlled.
And you somehow found a magical 70 acres in the Brunello district.
Well, you know, it was almost fool's luck because I wanted a vineyard, but mostly for ourselves, you know, just a small operation. And having looked at almost every bloody ruin in Tuscany, and there are no realtors in Tuscany, a word to that stage, and it's sort of you find a ruin and you go around the neighborhood asking who owns it, and people don't want to own up to it because they don't want anybody to know how much money they have, blah, blah, blah. And it's all sort of, you know, a very personal kind of long, long process of buying a ruin. And we finally found beautiful two little hills with this friary. And a friary, being so old, was added on to 14 different times. So it had these wings and courtyards and towers and stuff, you know. And it was right in Montalcino, and I knew it was a great zone for wine, but I never thought that we'd ever go into it in a big commercial way. And then we're halfway through rebuilding this house, and the vineyards next door, the wine estate next door, was bought by Angelo Gaia, who's Italy's best, most famous winemaker, whose wines sell for $300-$400 a bottle now, you know. And of course, we not instantly, but as soon as we got some emotional energy up, we stole his agronomist, his cellar master, the guy who grew his rootstock, all his advisors.
So all of these people were right next door.
Yeah, and they were, you know, this is Italy. I mean, the big social event in Italy or the great entertainment in Italy is not television. It's your neighbor. You go and talk to him. Whatever he's doing, you go and gossip, you know. So as we were building or rebuilding, all these guys would come over during the day and introduce themselves. And one day, Angelo Gaia came over, and I didn't know who he was, and he was carrying this case of, or this little wooden box of wine, you know, one bottle, those fancy boxes. And then I see his name and say, oh, my God, you're Angelo Gaia. So he gives us a bottle of wine, and we tasted it at a dinner sometime later, and my God, the flavors. Then it turned out to be Sori San Lorenzo, 1990, worth $400, and that was his calling card. His higher neighbor, you know, and then we gossiped. So, yeah, all these guys came and eventually hired them, and we brought in people from France who grew the rootstock, and this wonderful little Frenchman, Guillaume, came around, and he was flabbergasted by the soil because almost every field had different. One field was full of the biggest field was full of shells, and we were 1,000 feet up, you know.
Mm. So,
and you can imagine with all that calcium in the soil, what kind of flavors you get out. And most of Bordeaux is famed for that. Other fields is full of, like, you can see the layers of minerals. He was in awe, and he was so even. He didn't look at soil samples; he just started tasting and crunching
sure.
the soil, you know.
Smelling and tasting and
absolutely,
yeah.
And you know, I think if you start with the best soil and the best area, and try and really do the best product possible instead of going for quantity, especially in today's market, I think you always find people who want very original flavors and very genuine flavors, you know, unadulterated by industrial process.
You know, having just had enjoyed one of these Tuscany-style lunches with some wine critics and watching them experience a new wine as it's open for the first time. That's what they focus on a lot, they have an absolute hatred for big berries. You know?
Well, you know, the ideal berry is one with all skin, a bit of seed, and no juice, because that's all the flavor is, you know. We don't use fertilizer at all, and to end up with these boysenberry-looking things, you know, that pass for grapes, and also cuts back on your use of copper and sulfur, because
mm-hmm.
the more, the smaller the clusters are, the more, and we have a wind that starts blowing at 11 o'clock every morning as soon as the land heats up. Behind us, the sea wind comes in, only 20 miles from the sea. So they really aerate well and stay very healthy. And being very small, they give you enormous flavors and wonderful colors and great perfumes, you know. And you do go
broke. And that is the essence of the
absolutely
wine.
The essence, yeah. We have the Syrah, for example, which actually won the... there's a purveyor in New York called Morel's in Rockefeller Center, who's the most respected sort of wine merchant in America. And he named our Syrah the best Italian wine of this year. That Syrah is planted on 3,000-year-old terraces, and we work mostly by hand.
You mean the terraces were built 3,000 years ago?
Yeah, and our area was actually a commercial winery during the Roman times. It was so well-known even then,
mm-hmm.
Even though we're...
And, of course, that's what friars do, right?
Well, this was before the friars. This was gladiators.
Well, yeah, way before the friars. 3,000 years.
Yeah, the friars were new in Italian terms. Only 800 years ago they started building there, you know. But in the Syrah field of ours, we have, I think, close to 2,000 plants, and we have yet to get more than 800 bottles off them, you know. So you can imagine how much work goes into producing a bottle of wine. You're only getting half a bottle off each plant. If you go to a normal industrial vineyard, Jesus, you're going to get about two or three bottles off, or two bottles of a plant, you know.
And, of course, what the big industrial vineyards do is that they go for mass production. They're looking for as many grapes and as much juice as you can get out of a vine.
Well, in Montalcino, no, because there's competition. You know, like the little guys make such good wine that everybody has to sort of pull along. So they do have, and there's a control. You can only grow 7,000. Oh my God!
Yeah, take us through the Tuscany's appellation, or your Brunello Appellation Controlli.
Well, you're limited to 7,000. It doesn't matter what the numbers translate into. It's very little. 7,000 kilos per hectare. Okay, so about what the hell does that come to?
That's still worth 3,000 kilos per acre.
Per acre, yeah. Even less than that.
Yeah.
Of grape. Okay, and you're limited.
Of grapes? Wow.
Of grapes, yeah. So, you know, that you divide it by three quarters and you come up with about, I think the number is like 5,000 bottles of wine per hectare, you know.
Okay, I want to pick up the Appellation Controlli when we get back, because it's a fun story. And folks, we are having a fun today because we're breaking out of our ruts and traveling someplace new and doing something new. And specifically, we're traveling to the Tuscany of Italy, and we're building a winery with Ferenc Matte and you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Pick up your phone and join us and travel to the Tuscany. We will be right back. We're off to the Tuscany to plant some grapes and make some wine and live the good life with Ferenc Matte, author of A Vineyard in Tuscany. Ferenc is author of a number of books, including some sea stories, which I must get my hands on, being a fan of sea stories myself, and good food and great wine. Ferenc, when we were up in Oregon having this Tuscany-style meal with these wine critics and sampling a new vintage, just being opened, one of the things that they were cursing about is how the other vintners in the area were not too careful, I guess, about the grapes that they were buying, and so they were kind of messing with the quality and the reputation of the grapes of the region, and there was no control being exerted by anybody, and so those who are really trying to make a great wine, which is to say a wine with small berries, you know, from a good terroir, would have to have their wines lumped in the same, truck or basket with everybody else. It's not quite that way in your neck of the woods in the Tuscany, is it?
Well, I just made some calculations, and I'm no mathematician, that we're allowed only about 2,000 liters of wine per acre. Okay, to produce, and as I told you before, the Syrah that we have is 1 acre of field, and we're doing about 800 bottles, so we're way under even what you're allowed to do.
So you have the best wine of Italy, and you can only make 800 bottles, right?
Of that one, we do have the Brunello, of which we make 15,000, because we have 10 acres of it. But the point is that most people have now caught on to the idea that it has to be quality, there are very few people in our area, in Montalcino, who buy grapes from other people. Most people grow their own grapes and make their own wine.
Really? Is that true?
I think you
have home wineries everywhere then?
There's Bounty, who has 800 hectares of grapes, so they're not home, but they're very few people actually buy from others. Some of the big wineries do buy, and we did sell some of our grapes initially the first years, half of it, just to sort of stay afloat, and we didn't have a big enough winery to process it in. And the big guys do buy it, but the smaller people do process as soon as they have enough money to have a cellar. They do process their own grapes, yeah.
And
there isn't this sort of American thing where you go around and buy other people's grapes and make wine, which is a much more sensible thing to do because you don't have to worry about growing and mold and drought. You know, you buy whatever grape you can whenever you can.
Mm-hmm. But who says this is designed to make money so much here in the Tuscany? We're again talking human scale stuff, right?
Well, it's all designed for money, but the controls are such. You know, when you transport grapes, for example, even if say your cellars are farther away from your, you know, on your property, say some people's aren't, because they've built a space somewhere or had a space somewhere else or rented a space somewhere else. When you transport the grape, you have to have a document with you at the time declaring this grape is coming from place A going to place B. It's so many kilos, and the owner here is going to be shipped from this for such and such a purpose. You know, so it's really, really controlled. You can be stopped and really fined heavily, which is strange in Italy, which is basically a free-for-all, but they're really trying to crack down on quality and maintain the quality of these appellation-controlled wines.
Right.
Florence, this is Marlene.
Oh, hi.
I'm sitting in the studio as well. I have a question for you.
It's a family affair, huh?
Yes, it is, as yours is. Can you tell me about the labor in Tuscany? Certainly 70 acres is too much for you two to be handling yourselves.
Oh, that's including woods, though. We only have 15 acres of vines.
Oh, I see. So
and
you
another,
do.
Another three or four of olives, but they require very, very little labor. We don't fertilize them or plow them or anything. You sort of grow and we pick them when they're ready, you know.
Ah.
Do you
but we do have two fixed workers who've been with us for, one of them has been there for 8 years and the other one for about five now. And they go through the entire cycle. They're with us constantly. And we do hire people when we have to tie, which is has to be done a certain time, or we have to thin the leaves out to get more air around the grapes and get the wild shoots off. And for picking, of course, we do have everybody's family and friends coming down, you know. So we do have at times up to seven or eight people working for short periods.
And what about, there's such a control over the use of land in the Tuscany. And one of the questions producer Carol Stafford asked was that she saw television video travel log about the Tuscany, and she said it all looks so rural and so calm and so peaceful, and why doesn't it look like every place else? And that, of course, is because there are some incredibly strict zoning rules with respect to who can use what land, right?
Very much. And even to plant any vineyard, you have to have, for example, you're trying to keep down the amount of grapes being grown in Tuscany. So to plant an acre of vineyards, you have to have someone else in some other part of Tuscany tear up an older vineyard and sell you the permit they had for that vineyard, okay?
So it's kind of like tobacco used to be here.
So stop growing it. We can't grow any more grapes in Tuscany than already were grown, okay, basically. And this goes for almost all of the European community now. You have to tear up an old vineyard to plant a new vineyard.
So did you have to buy somebody's...
Oh, yeah, yeah. We had 2 hectares of Brunello rights came with the house because we bought the land from Banfi, the big vintner, who had 13 beautiful ruins for sale at one point, you know. But we bought 5.
What was that like? What was that experience of buying rights like?
Well, the rights was amazing because to get any kind of size together, you're dealing with little tiny farmers who had, you know, maybe 400 vines, which is about a fifth of a hectare or an acre, you know. So to plant our vineyards, I think we went to about 7 or 8 different people to collect all the enough rights. But everything was sort of done through an intermediary, and people didn't want to pay high taxes on this, so most of the money is cash, you know, brown paper bags. You do get a certificate at the end, but it was all this sort of very mysterious. Nobody knew where it came from, but there was a real certificate, but you didn't quite declare the entire amount and stuff.
It was
a real adventure in faith and trust, you know.
You talk about the importance of having your word be your bond.
Well, because of that, you know, I think this whole human bond is so strong in Tuscany. Neighbors, and there's a saying in Tuscany that neighbors are more important to you than your family or than your relatives, because your relatives can be far away, but your life depends on a neighbor, and physically it does. I mean, neighbors still help each other constantly when there's something to be done, road work, or even somebody needs some kind of help. It's, you know, you go to your neighbor first of all, or they usually even notice by rumor it's happening, and they just come and help you anyway. Or when Candace was sick one time, and doctors still come to the house in Tuscany, no matter how far you are out. And she got pneumonia because she was working out in her vegetable garden in the pouring rain. And the doctor couldn't come back to give her the penicillin shots or the antibiotic shots every twice a day. So the neighbor, who was not a nurse, but she had done it to her rabbits before, so she came and gave Candace her shots. You know, just an understood thing that you do, that you look after each other, you know.
Good. When we come back from this break, I want to ask about what it takes to be a small label in a world of big labels. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Ferenc Maté, who is the author of A Vineyard in Tuscany, a Hungarian in Italy via United States, correct?
Yes. from Transylvania, no less.
From Transylvania, okay. And you're invited to participate today. Pick up your phone and join us. Anything you wanted to know about the Tuscany is yours at your fingertips today, 831-479-1080. And 479-1080 here in the Monterey Bay Area, and 831-624-2665. Welcome back, folks. We're escaping the rat race today. We're heading for Tuscany to build a vineyard in a winery and make great wines, eat good foods, and kvetch with the neighbors with Ferenc Maté, who is the author of A Vineyard in Tuscany. Ferenc, the producer, Carol Stafford, says be sure and put out the website because there are some great photographs there.
Oh, yeah, a friend put that together. Well, it's pretty easy to photograph Tuscany. pretty photogenic. It's Ferenc Maté, F as in Frank, ErencMate.com.
So who did the photographs?
Oh, I did. I do photography as well, but as I say, it's pretty easy. Honest, with all the problems that we do have every day, the daily problems of running a winery and the vineyard, I'm telling you, Michael, there isn't a day that goes by that I just don't sort of stop at whatever time of day and say, my God, this is paradise, you know, with this series of hills like those Chinese watercolors rolling off to the horizon and the sunsets and the light and the fragrances.
Don't you miss the big city? Come on.
Hey, well, listen, there are problems. You know, the original title of the book was, now it's called A Vineyard in Tuscany, A Wine Lover's Dream, right?
Uh-huh.
But my original title is going to be A Vineyard in Tuscany, Our Own Hell in Paradise. So. But getting back to the question about labor, we do Candace works, you know, 12 hours a day in the winery, and we've divided up. We've been together 35 years, and built a sailboat together, and houseboat together, and sailed around the Pacific together, and built a house together. And we thought, after 35 years of being side by side, edited books together and wrote books together, we thought that after 35 years it'd be time to sort of give each other some space, because, you know, most couples we have read spend about 2 hours in close proximity per day, and we spend about 14 to 15, so it's not 35 years of marriage, really, it's 217. So we thought it's time to get some distance. So I run the vineyard and I look after the vines, and she actually is a cellar master. She did a 2-year course, sommelier course in Rome, plus Carlo Corino, who was not an enologist, but enologist to the enologist. He was actually a consultant to consultants. He was like the senior figure in Italy. And he fell in love with Candace, so to speak, and taught her absolutely everything about winemaking. So we had sort of a leg up on this.
And there are two different worlds, right?
Oh, they are. But it's nice they overlap. You can still work. You know, I help out a lot in the cellar and Candace works.
Mm-hmm. And vice versa, yeah.
But it's so wonderful to have those two different aspects, you know, being outside in the fresh air, constantly working. And it's such a social event, because the workers, the two guys that we have, as I said, it's been together forever. It's like nonstop talk. You know, you never have to ask where they are. You can hear them talking. You know, it's always about sex and cars and sex, you know. So it's a big kind of family event constantly. And
weather, got to talk about the weather.
And weather, no, just sex and cars.
Uh-huh.
But then in the cellar, you know, it's kind of monastic and quiet, except, you know, oh, the other day, Jesus, I was, you know, I'm such a stickler for perfection, and we were pumping over, actually. We do mostly hand punching down, so I wasn't that used to pumping over, and you let the wine out into this little vat to give some oxygen so yeast can work, and there's a pump, and you're up on top of the vat wetting down the cap with a hose that comes from the vat, the little vat below, and I noticed that the wine wasn't coming quite as fast. I said, what the hell, maybe some grapes got into it or something, and I looked down, and running off out the door into the dirt is this river of $20 a bottle Brunello. You know, one of those moments in your life when you sort of want to go back 5 minutes and sort of start over again, make it just somehow different. Anyway, there are some drawbacks, but it really is fun most of the time.
Let me ask you about one of my favorite subjects, which is how you survive and prosper as a small label in a world dominated by big labels.
Well, you know, in wine, it almost works for you. You know, the smaller you are, the more people like to think, and it's true, that they're gonna get something totally unique and special because the terroir is so expressive in our wines that we spent about 2 months going through Bordeaux and Bourgogne, studying wineries for equipment and stuff.
Tough job.
Yeah, it's tough.
Tough job. Somebody has to do it,
and
right?
Talk to small vintners, you know, and small growers and small winemakers. And we got back home and tasted our wines, and we went to Saint-Emilion and Chateau Margaux and stuff, great wines, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then you go home and taste your wine and say, oh my God, this stuff's really good, you know? And it really is. I'm surprised constantly at how, what you can, if you let the terroir really express itself and not force things and not use fertilizer and not over-cultivate it, and we green prune savagely. I mean, you know, we could probably grow easily 10,000 bottles a hectare instead of the 5 that we do. You get up with these concentrated flavors that are just really amazing. You know? And I let the grapes hang forever. I mean, I go up to 26 bricks, 27 sometimes. You know, and we have a problem with alcohol sometimes, but because you balance it out with growth from farther down the hill, that's not as bad, but you do get some amazing flavors out of it, and perfume.
And the more flavors, the more perfume, the better the wine.
Yeah, and you know,
and,
the thing
and
is,
the more people talk about it.
They do, and we had a leg up. Having Angelo Gaia next door, you just drop that, you know, Angelo Gaia is the next door neighbor, and people kind of genuflect, you know. And,
mm-hmm.
and Carlo Corino's your enologist. People say, oh, my God, Carlo Corino. And it helps being from North America. It's kind of a... plus, we have, you know, Brunello, of course, is so well-known. It's Italy's best-known wine, probably best-loved wine. Except maybe some Barbarescos, that, you know, you're really starting with a leg up. So I think if you get into the best zone with the best soil and the best advisors, it's not that difficult to get into the market.
I have a question. Are the labels painted by your wife?
Yes. Oh, my God. Did we go through this? We tried, you know, the French Chateau, the, you know, beige on beige, you know, with the little drawings of the house. And we tried Egyptian sculptures, and nothing worked. And all of a sudden, Candace had been a painter forever, and she showed it in Italy and in New York. And I said, Candace, look at these fabulous paintings. I was sitting in a tower one day where I write, and the sun came in, and her paintings are all over my tower because I love them. And the sun just sort of hit on a spot in the painting. I thought, this is fabulous. So I said, look, let's just use details from all your paintings, different details.
Yes.
Hold on. Got to take a quick break. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Parence, Matei, and the Tuscany right back. Off to the Tuscany with Ferenc Matei. And we're drinking wine and having lunch. Now, we have a few minutes left, and I thought the thing to do would be to have a lunch with Ferenc.
Oh my God, that'll be
cruel. Take us through a lunch, will you, Ferenc?
Well, any normal lunch, we have a three-course meal. We start with a pasta, and luckily we have a neighbor who's about 2-3 houses down who comes in once a week and helps Candace make handmade pasta. And Michael, you've not eaten pasta until you've eaten handmade. It just melts in your mouth, and the flavor is amazing stuff.
My mother used to make it.
Oh, you're kidding.
No, it was raised on.
Well, then you know what I'm talking about. So we start with that, either with the meat sauce or more often than not, the vegetable sauce. And everything very much in season. You know, we have wild asparagus, we have artichokes, and we make sauces out of that. And then, of course, in the fall, we have porcini. We have a porcinaio behind the house, which is a place where porcini mushrooms grow century after century, you know. So we do have these oak trees, some wonderful porcini and some truffles we don't have, the only thing. So anyway, we have all this stuff on the pasta. And then roast meats are a big thing in Tuscany. Either done, not grilled, but roasted beside the fire. So chicken takes about 2 hours to grill.
Tell us the difference between roasting and like barbecuing.
Well, barbecue, you have meat right over the coals, right? And
right.
And the stuff drips back into the coals, and it smokes and all that kind of stuff. Roasting, and you actually put into a vertical, you split the chicken or pheasant or whatever you have, or ribs even, you put them into a vertical vertically standing grill beside the fire, and you leave it there for about 15 minutes at a time. You keep turning it, and it takes about an hour to do this way, or an hour for ribs and 2 hours for chicken. Really, I spend forever. But then the juices stay inside, and the skin becomes like parchment. It's just all flavor, you know, just like a grape. You know, it's a little to it. But and you're starting with, of course, you're starting with wild-raised chicken. And they don't look like chickens. They look like racing chickens. You know, they have long, skinny legs and hardly any meat on them because they're running out in the forest and woods, and we have to spend hours getting them back every day. But the flavors you get out of this stuff, roasted beside a fire, is... Can I go and eat now?
here, Chicky Chicky, yeah, okay.
You have salad and some fruit. Fruit you always have instead of... We don't really eat much in the way of sweets. Mostly fruit after the salad. And we have some very good cheeses around, some great cheap cheeses. So you have that with the wine. And, of course, we always consume, I would say, half bottle, but more often than a bottle of wine, two of us at lunch when our son's off at university now. So we have a good time in the afternoon. And then we have a repeat in the evening.
And you do two big meals a day, right?
Yeah, the dinner tends to be a bit smaller. Less food, but more wine, you know, and you don't eat as much meat during that. Your night, you sleep a bit better if you don't. But a lot of family get together, neighbors get together, sort of, you know, and cook together a lot.
Well, the obvious question then is alcoholism. Let me ask you.
You know, I have never seen a fall down drunk in Italy, not like you see in other parts of the world. I mean, our kid, when he was 5 or 4, would drink wine at home, or he goes to a restaurant and have a sip of wine. They are so used to drinking. In absolutely moderate quality. I had to escape the house for a month to write because so much activity going on to finish this book. And I went to Venice. A friend of mine had an apartment, and I was there during the Carnevale, this big, huge mass ball that goes on for a week. And kids from everywhere were. Venice is packed. You know, there's a live music, and every street corner and rock bands, and everybody's drinking like crazy. And I didn't see one person totally drunk, and everybody's just having a great time. There are no arguments, there are no fights. I mean, I think if you're brought up with wine all your life, you know that it's
The difference.
A joyous event. It's not something you'll hide in the car. And
okay,
the car.
Franz, we're out of time. Franz Mattei, author of A Vineyard in Tuscany. I'm going right
good.
Now.
You come and visit. We need great company.
On the way, Franz, thank you very much.
Thank
folks,
you, Michael.
Folks, stay tuned for
else.
Next week. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.